Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 24th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, WCAI's Jeanette Barnes will speak with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House, and we'll speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. A lot to cover. Now, here's a look at some of the news around the Cape and the islands. A cluster of new coronavirus cases has been linked to a house party in Chatham. Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, the last number I saw for this was 10 cases related to this party. Tell us what we know about it and its impacts on the community.
Sure. That's the last information we had was 10 cases. At first, the Department of Public Health notified the Chatham Public Health Department on Tuesday that there were 9 cases, but a 10th was reported on Wednesday. According to the DPH, there was a party on July 12th. We don't know where, but somewhere in Chatham, between 30 and 50 people attended. And many of them were restaurant workers, and that's what really gotten people in the community a little bit worried. We don't know exactly how many were restaurant workers or where they worked. According to the town, only one of those 10 people are Chatham that who tested positive are Chatham residents. But at least 3 local restaurants have closed in the last few days because one of their employees tested positive. Now, Dr. Robert Duncanson, who's director of the town's Department of Natural Resources, told us that it was unclear if any of those cases were related to the party. But clearly, there's concern in the community about restaurants and workers, and people are worried about how that's going to impact things.
We don't know a lot about this party, right, Tim? But one thing that does seem apparent is that people there were not wearing masks and were not social distancing. Is that right?
That's what we're told by the DPH, that people there were not wearing masks. Apparently, there were no reports about this particular party to the Chatham Police Department. So we really don't know where it was. The town says they're trying to get that information from the DPH. We don't know if it was in a year-round neighborhood, a seasonal neighborhood, or on the beach, or where it was. Apparently, it was a house party, but it could have been anywhere. And that's got some people worried too in town. They're kind of concerned about whether this thing happened in their neighborhood.
Tell us about how the restaurants, a little bit more about how restaurants are responding. There's even a protocol that they have to go to now if one of their employees tests positive. Tell us about that.
Sure. If an employee tests positive, a restaurant is supposed to shut down and do a deep cleaning and disinfecting of the facility. The employee who's tested positive is not to come into work and should self-isolate. And also anyone who's been in close contact with that person should isolate until they can be tested. The restaurants that have closed in Chatham have done so following those protocols. Some of them say that they'll be opening up within a couple days, they expect. Others say they don't know when they're going to be opening up. 2 restaurants in Chatham actually changed from having dining room service to going back to only takeout out of abundance of caution. At one of them, a friend of one of the workers tested positive, and the other, they're just doing it out of caution. I think there's some concern in town, and you can see this on Facebook and in other social media that people are going to shy away from going to restaurants because of this whole incident.
And Tim, we should mention that there's a pop-up testing clinic that will be held Monday to test anyone who was at this party or have had contact with people at the party.
That's exactly right, Steve. The town and the Barnstable County Health Department, along with Cape Cod Healthcare, will conduct that pop-up testing clinic at the Town Hall Annex on George Ryder Road from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Monday. Folks have to pre-register to attend. They can find that information on the town website or on our website. Officials are hoping that this will sort of indicate whether there was any other exposures to the COVID virus at that party. They haven't had any new reports in the last couple of days, but I think what they're hoping is that people who are unsure whether they were exposed at the party or to someone who attended the party will come to this clinic, and they'll be able to get an indication, a better indication of how much exposure there was at that particular cluster.
Tim, we have just about a minute more, not much time, but I want to ask you about Harwich Port. There's a mandatory mask order in effect now for Harwich Port downtown.
Yeah, the Harwich Port Board, the Harwich Board of Health this week followed the really kind of the Chatham lead and mandated that masks be worn in downtown Harwich Port. And this follows actually a disclosure that two restaurants had employees who tested positive in downtown Harwich Port. There's no indication, or we don't know yet, if those two people attended that party. But the Harwich Health Department sent out letters to, as the Chatham Health Department did, sent out letters to all restaurants after this cluster was discovered. And the Harwich Board of Health felt that for the safety of everyone in Harwich Port, they should require that folks wear masks there. And you know, town officials in both communities are also stressing, you know, social distancing, and also washing hands to help stem any further spread.
It's Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Cuttyhunk Island had pretty much escaped the coronavirus up until this past week or so, and then it was there. Noah Asimov of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with the story. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Noah, this seemed to happen very quickly. One case was announced, and then not long after, we were talking about eight cases. Lay out what happened here.
Yeah, so the first positive test, I guess, occurred last Wednesday. That was a female. I was talking to the selectman. That was a female who had apparently spent a week and a half on the island, and she started to show symptoms of the disease, which they originally assumed were allergies. But then on Wednesday of last week, she lost her sense of smell, which is, of course, like an immediate indicator. And she immediately left the island, got tested, and the test came back positive. And that sort of initiated a, you know, and launched a mass sort of public health response from the island's, you know, tiny public health infrastructure. They contacted the state. More tests were ordered. I think they identified 25 close contacts. And when the test came back on Monday of this week, five more people had tested positive from those, and two more people had tested positive off island, which made a total of eight people. So it was just sort of like a crazy giant. It can show you how it happens. You know, one person tests positive and then eight more immediately.
So, for folks who don't know, Cuttyhunk, just sketch out how remote and tiny this place is.
Well, it's part of the town of Gosnold, which encompasses the Elizabeth Islands chain. Cuttyhunk is the only public island in the Elizabeth Islands chain, but it's also the most remote of the islands. All the other ones are privately owned. It's, I think, the smallest town in the state of Massachusetts. Gosnold, it's the seventh town in Dukes County. And it's, you know, I mean, it's really out there. There's no hospital. There's barely a restaurant. It's only accessible via passenger ferry, so people can't even bring their cars there. I mean, maybe it's possible, but most people don't. And when you're on land, everyone gets around by golf cart. So, I mean, it really is sort of the outermost reach of the state, pretty much. And it was stretching for, you know, the public health infrastructure when the virus got there, no question.
So folks, they have to get medical service. They have to get on the ferry and get to New Bedford. Is that right?
Right. Well, if you need hospital service, generally, I guess what happens is people will take the ferry to New Bedford. But in this instance, during the summer months, they actually have, this is kind of interesting, a rotating crew of doctors that will come each for a week and stay at a house. And so, you know, it's mainly doctors who are on vacation and want to spend a week on vacation. But it's just also so that the island always has someone there if there's a need that arises. So I guess in this instance, the doctor has been, you know, informed about what's going on. And it also means there's only one doctor on the island. And if anyone needs hospital care, they have to leave. And so now they've had to institute all of these sort of unique, I guess, rules for how people are going to be able to get on and off the ferry. They need to wear a full protective PPE suit if you have tested positive and want to leave. There's been discussion about whether the people who did test positive are going to have to leave or not. I think as of Monday of this week, four of the people who had tested positive were still on the island, and there was sort of a debate amongst their families, you know, whether they were going to quarantine there or they were going to go to places off island. I guess everyone who tested positive does have a place off island, but that's not true of everyone on Cutty Hunk. There is a year-round population. It's small, it numbers in the dozens, but there are people there. And actually, I caught up with the selectmen last night, what's happened now is that the island has actually tested 97 people for the virus, and they've brought in public health nurses from the state just because when all the other people tested positive, of course, you know, the number of contacts grows sort of exponentially. So, yeah, it's trying for them.
It must feel early in the pandemic, it must have felt like the remoteness of the island was a safe thing. Now it must make them
right.
feel very fragile, really. You think about that.
Right, yeah. I mean, that it's an island, I think, where people are totally familiar with social distancing. You know, that's why you go there. But, it, you know, when something like this happens, I think it did kind of shock people. And I think it was concerning for a lot of the residents, you know, many of whom are close. I think there's a lot of people who are, you know, everyone's on a first name basis, and the community is small, and you're used to being out on the ocean and isolated together, and this can be, you know, difficult in that respect too.
That's Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Cape Cod marked an anniversary of sorts yesterday. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to explain. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, great to be here.
Jeanette, yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the most unusual weather event on Cape Cod in many of our lifetimes. Not just a tornado, but three tornadoes in a single day. You took a look back at this for us. Tell us a little bit about what happened that day.
Right. So the whole series of events started in terms of the tornadoes just a few minutes before noon, and the three of them all touched down within about 15 or 20 minutes time. So that was in Hyannis, in West Yarmouth, and Harwich. Initially, the reports were, I think, two tornadoes, but at some point, the National Weather Service determined that there actually was a third one as well that was only down for a minute. At least one of them started as a waterspout offshore and then came ashore in Hyannis and headed east. There was a lot of tree damage, major tree damage, but no one was injured. So that was like a really remarkable, I guess, and positive thing about the whole thing. The most memorable piece of damage, which people probably do remember, is that there was a motel, the Cape Sands Inn, that had a big section of the roof blown off. Mm.
You went out there to the Cape Sands Inn to talk to the staff about what they remember from that day a year ago. Tell us about what you heard.
Yes. So the housekeeping manager is probably the person I spoke to that was the closest to what was happening. The motel is arranged in three wings, kind of in a U shape. And the left side of the U, as you look at it, is where the roof was blown off. The doors face outside. And so she was up on the second level on that sort of walkway that's outdoors. And she looked across toward Hyannis, and she saw this swirling gray cloud coming, and she knew that this was not good, and she was telling people to get down. She herself kind of backed into a room where there was a cleaner in the room, and she says that she was gripping the doorknob for dear life, trying to make sure that she would be okay, and she actually saw, as she described it, the roof peel off like a banana right over her head. The roof is now fixed, but you can see still where the flagpole was bent pretty deeply by the wind. Yeah.
The flagpole is still there.
The flagpole is still there, still in place, still bent. Yeah, actually,
Well, a year later now, after this event, the motel still hasn't fully reopened.
Right. So the owner said that he is having some trouble getting the insurance settlement. But in any case, the two wings that did not have the roof blown off just opened this past June. And when I visited last week, the main area that was affected, that wing still is not complete, is not open. There were some people there working on the railing and the overhang and such.
Tell us more about the damage around the rest of the Mid-Cape area.
Right. So as I said, there was not a lot of property damage. I believe there was at least one house that had a hole poked in the roof by a falling tree. But Lincoln Hooper, who is the director of public works in Harwich, he told me that he was driving back from Orleans. And the tree situation was so bad, he said it was the first time he ever feared for his life, basically watching all these trees and limbs come down around him. He says the brush pile at the Harwich DPW was five times what the town normally takes in a whole year. So like within the 2 weeks after the storm during the cleanup, it was just a massive, massive amount of brush and trees. All three of those tornadoes were classified as EF1. The two of them were at the top of that EF1 scale, which is 110 miles per hour winds, and the other one was a little bit smaller, lesser winds.
Again, I just want to underscore how amazing it is that three tornadoes touched down on the Cape in July and nobody was injured. It's just almost hard to conceive how that happened and they did that much damage. Jeanette Barnes, WCAA's Jeanette Barnes, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Provincetown has some new street art. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Marianne, this is an idea that took some time to become reality. Tell us about what's happened here.
You're right about that. The idea basically kind of surfaced publicly in January. But what it is it's rainbow-colored paint being added to an existing crosswalk, two crosswalks right in the center of Provincetown, particularly where people who are visiting for the summer would, you know, kind of enter the town. Either coming from the ferries where they would walk down the pier and cross this crosswalk, and also as they might drive in, they would drive across the crosswalk as they enter what's really considered the town's major parking lot right downtown. So it's basically called a rainbow painted crosswalk, and it's common in other kind of other larger cities, but that's what was installed on Wednesday, and then they had the ribbon cutting for it yesterday.
Tell us about what it's symbolizing for the town and the energy about how this all came about.
Well, for the sponsors of the idea are the Provincetown Business Guild, which promotes LGBTQ tourism, and also a place called the Provincetown LGBTQ Center. So they came up with the idea in January, brought it to the select board. But the idea really dates back all the way back to 1978, where the rainbow flag was stitched by a person named Gilbert Baker following the death of gay rights activist Harvey Milk that same year. And that rainbow flag basically grew in popularity. At that time, it was eight colors, I believe. And since now it's only six colors, but generally it's associated with LGBTQ rights. But also from the Business Guild's perspective here in Provincetown, they see it a little more universally as a symbol of a welcoming spirit of the town, a sense of inclusion, safety, and progressiveness.
Have you gone out and gotten your picture standing on it yet?
I did. As soon as I heard it was painted, I drive down and drove through the square. And if anybody, it's right in Lope Square. It's that same area where the lobster pot tree at Christmas time is. It's a crosswalk where people can sit. There's tons of, you know, benches, and there's that big anchor if you've been ever driven right, you know, downtown. And it's very bright right now, so we'll see by the end of the summer, you know, how it does with foot traffic and people driving across it and so on. And it's, you know, it's definitely already people were starting to take pictures of it. And that was really one of the issues with, they originally proposed it to be into four other kind of busier areas. And one of the concerns was that from a public safety perspective, that people would be stopping to take pictures, and that it would be better that it would not be on kind of a more main street. So they moved it to this Slope Square. It's like a crosswalk, more, it's a little bit off the main drag of Commercial Street.
That is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner talking about the rainbow-colored crosswalks painted out in Provincetown. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
COVID cases keep showing up on Nantucket, slowly, slowly. Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, Nantucket seemed to be escaping the pandemic for a large part of the spring and early summer. And we're still talking about small numbers here, but tell us what's happening.
Sure, we are still talking about relatively small numbers, certainly in comparison to other communities around the state and around the country. But yes, there were two times since mid-March, since the pandemic began in this country, Nantucket went 22 days on one occasion and 34 days on another without a single case. But as of yesterday afternoon, there are now 36 confirmed cases of coronavirus reported on the island since testing began. There were no new cases reported yesterday for the first time in 6 days, but the number of tests awaiting results had spiked to 252 as well. The majority of those who are testing positive on the island, 60%, are in their 20s and 30s, our town's health director says. More concerning, potentially, or certainly a number that pops up, is that 22 of those 36 cases have occurred since June 22nd, as summer visitors have begun to arrive in larger numbers. Seven of those confirmed cases have been reported in the last week. Three of those were employees at a single island restaurant and mark what Health Director Roberto Santamaria believes to be the island's first known case of public community spread. He didn't identify the restaurant, but did say the spread was believed to have been exacerbated by the dormitory housing in which some of those employees live. No customers who visited the restaurant had tested positive for coronavirus as of Wednesday evening, he said. This is concerning to town officials, to Roberto Santamaria, the health director, but not particularly because of the restaurant, but the slow creep of the numbers. And town officials are saying if those numbers spike up and don't just continue to sort of slowly increase, they will seriously take into consideration implementing further, more stringent restrictions, potentially eliminating indoor dining at restaurants, restricting or ceasing outdoor dining, and perhaps requiring curbside pickup for retail stores. The Board of Health is going to meet this afternoon to discuss that, but the town officials were quick to point out that a case a day or a case every couple of days or even two cases in one day would not necessarily precipitate that, but it is something they're thinking about.
Josh, let me ask you about another story we've been talking about on the roundup with you over the last few weeks. It's the discovery of PFAS in the groundwater around the airport. Bring us up to date with what's happening now.
Sure. This week, the Select Board declared a state of emergency in the neighborhood, primarily in order to secure additional funding to further test and potentially filter out the cancer-causing chemicals known as PFAS from the groundwater south and west of the airport. Those contaminants are believed to have entered the water from firefighting foam that the airports used during years of training exercises. They implemented a policy last year to keep the foam contained in a way that would prevent it from entering the groundwater during any additional testing, but they haven't even used it at all since October 2018. Last week, the Airport Commission approved nearly $1 million contract with its environmental consultants to install filtration systems on homes that had not yet received them, that had levels considered too high by the State Department of Environmental Protection, as well as test and install filters where necessary at another 23 homes. They have about $500,000 in their coffers to get this done, and the declaration of the state of emergency should allow them to expend more than that under state law.
Josh, it is political season, and it seems like Nantucket's always on the route for some politicians. Vice President Pence is scheduled to come this weekend?
He is. Nantucket is a big campaign stop, big fundraising stop, obviously. And Governor Charlie Baker is planning to meet with Vice President Mike Pence this weekend on Nantucket, primarily to discuss the federal response to the coronavirus pandemic. Pence is scheduled to be here for a fundraiser at the home of Robert Reynolds, who is the CEO of Putnam Investments. And that's a $25,000 a head lunch where the Republican Party and the campaign to reelect Donald Trump and Mike Pence hopes to raise about $1 million.
That is Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
The accused killer of Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon was in court this week. And even to have a court hearing is a news story in the midst of the pandemic. Ethan Genter wrote about it in the Cape Cod Times. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Ethan, tell us about this hearing and what's happening with this case.
Yeah, so this is the case for Thomas Platanowicz. He's accused of killing Sean Gannon, who was a Yarmouth police officer, while Gannon was serving a search warrant, arrest warrant in Marston's Mills. So this week on Tuesday, Platanowicz was in court. His attorney was arguing to A, get the charges dismissed against him, and B, get some evidence suppressed.
This was an unusual hearing, as I was saying, because we haven't seen court hearings during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone who goes into this is in Barnstable Superior Court. Everyone who walks in has to get their temperature checked. Everyone needs to wear masks. There was a few witnesses called at this hearing. They stood at a stand that was wiped down and sanitized every time someone new came up. They were offered face shields, witnesses. Attorneys, instead of approaching witnesses with evidence like they normally do, they put it on a projector that was then looked at on a TV screen. Masks were taken off when people were talking. That was kind of the closest as to a normal hearing as we got.
What happens next with the Platanowicz case now?
So these two motions that they were argued on Tuesday need to be decided upon. The attorney for Mr. Platanowicz was also he's also planning to try and get this moved off of the Cape. He doesn't believe his client with such a high-profile case can get a fair trial on Cape Cod, so he's trying to move that off of Cape. This is going to kind of go along. The earliest we're looking at is there's hearings before the trial still scheduled into November. So it's going to be a while before this has happened, which I know has been frustrating for some people because this did happen in 2018 and we haven't even gone to trial yet.
Ethan, you also reported this week on some state legislation that a number of local communities are grateful to see moving to the governor's desk. This is a budget amendment that will get towns off the hook for the Steamship Authority deficit related to the pandemic. What are some of the details here?
Yeah, so for people who don't know, the Steamship Authority, our ferry line out here that services the islands, is very different than most public transit authorities. They run on their own money. So whatever money they take in from ticket sales, that's what pays the bills. They don't get any money from the state or the feds, really. So when ticket sales plummeted because no one's riding the ferries due to COVID-19 at the start of the pandemic, they got really worried. They were looking at deficits into the tens of millions. I think 60-ish, 60 million was kind of one of the higher looks at a shortfall here. And so when the Steamship Authority runs at a deficit, the five port communities of Barnstable, Falmouth, New Bedford, the Vineyard, and Nantucket have to basically bail out the Steamship Authority at the end of the year. So that was a big concern, especially now predictions are right around 22 to 25 million, I believe, for a deficit at the end of the year. So these municipalities who are also facing their own belt tightening were really worried that they were also going to have to pay for the Steamship Authority to dig itself out here. There, in the supplemental budget bill in the state, an amendment was made that got the kind of the burden to pay for this shifted from those port communities to the state, which was, like you said, a pretty big relief to everybody in the port communities.
So these communities have never actually had to cover a Steamship Authority debt yet. This would have been a first and also a pretty big deal for them, obviously, if it's we're talking about tens of millions of dollars. And those communities are Barnstable and Falmouth and New Bedford, which each would be responsible for 10% of that deficit. And then Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket would be responsible for the other 35% each of that deficit. So huge for them if they had to cover this. What happens now? This is just a bill, but the governor is expected to sign this, right?
Yeah, I haven't heard any. Also, I believe they have had to do this once in the
very
beginning
right?
of the Steamship Authority. I believe so. But the governor still has to sign this, I believe. I have not heard that he has any intention not to, but I always want to see the signature on there before everyone signs their relief. But, yeah, I think this is expected to go through. There still are concerns kind of what happens between now and then. The Steamship Authority still needs money to run. So this is not a silver bullet, to use a cliche here.
But the Steamship Authority has seen its numbers come back up significantly, not as much as previous summers, but it's running now with higher numbers than it was through the spring, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe the July 4th weekend was almost back to normal, and they are slowly inching back. A few weeks ago, when I talked to the Steamship Authority, they kind of said it's getting back to, it's kind of like running on a parallel line. It's running at kind of the same curve, just an octave lower here.
That is Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times speaking to us. Ethan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yep, have a good one, Steve.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Post offices on Martha's Vineyard have a hard time of it in the summer, and this summer post offices are even busier than ever. The Martha's Vineyard Times has the story, and George Brennan wrote it, and he joins us to talk about it. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, there's some shoe leather reporting here, but it's not your own shoe leather there. Rather, you got your interns involved. Tell us a little bit about this story. It's a good one.
Thank you. So we have five interns this summer. I should point out that they're all working, except for one of them, are working for credit. So I did get a little feedback on Twitter. You have five interns, so they're all looking for experience and credit, not necessarily getting paid. So I wanted to point that out first off. But also, we had this idea. People were complaining about the length of lines at post offices and not getting packages. So how do you figure out if there are these lines? You send them to the post office. And so each one of them was sent at the same time, 1 o'clock last Thursday, and they stood in line, and some of them got through very easily in the Up Island post office, not unexpected. And then in places like Oak Bluffs and Vineyard Haven and Edgartown, there were much longer waits. Vineyard Haven being the worst of them, almost a full hour waiting in line just to get to the counter and then make a purchase. So, and then we talked to the post office about this to find out what the issue is and why this always happens. And it's basically the influx of people. They're just not equipped. These buildings are too small. Vineyard Haven, for example, there are two tents put up behind it. to keep the packages out of the weather, because they have so many packages there that they don't have the room for them inside. It's a volume issue, and they just simply can't meet it. Interestingly, within days of this story going up, the post office announced that they were going to expand hours on the island, and starting this weekend, there'll be weekend hours at each of the post office. They're trying to, weed out some of the backlog in packages and delivering those to people. So there's some good news from this story that these interns worked hard on.
George, let me ask you about another story you have in the paper this week. The island's ag fair isn't happening this summer, so it's trying something different to raise funds.
Yeah, a lot of people are sad about that, too. It's such a tradition, you know, the cotton candy and, riding on rides and the pig races and you name it, the tractor pull. So we're not going to have that this summer. There is a virtual fair that's going to happen, but that's not going to bring in the kind of revenue that the Ag Society needs. They get the bulk of their revenue from this fair. They do have some weddings as well where they get some revenue. Those aren't happening either. So they're pretty much getting no revenue this year. So they came up with this idea for an auction, and they're going to be auctioning off things that people are donating, and some of the things sound really cool. And we have a picture of one of the items, which is this Ford tractor. I don't think I can get in on the bidding on that. It's probably going to go way over what I could afford, but man, would I love to have that. It's a beautiful machine.
It's an old machine. It's a vintage machine.
Absolutely. Dates back. Sorry, I can't find the date.
1947, I think. Yeah.
There you go. 1947. Yeah, absolutely. They're hoping that will bring a big chunk of money in. It's a $250,000 deficit that they're facing as a result of not having the fair alone. So, big chunk of money for them. And it's not as if this fair is a big money maker. They spend a lot to bring it in, but they want to be able to continue doing that. It's a long-standing tradition on the island. More than next year will be the 160th year that they've held it. So, they want to be able to continue doing this, something cherished on the island, to be sure.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Take care, Steve.
House lawmakers are poised to vote on their version of a police reform bill today after nearly two dozen hours of sometimes tense negotiations on Beacon Hill. WCAI's Catherine Ident talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about the deal-making. Here's the conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, the big news this week out of Beacon Hill was that the House has been working on its version of a police reform bill. As lawmakers are rushing to get to consensus on this before they break for the rest of the summer. And Mike, I should know this from talking to you, but I will say I pictured vibrant debates on the floor this week, but that's not how bills get done on Beacon Hill, is it?
No, never watch the sausage getting made. And in the case of the Massachusetts legislature, the sausage gets made behind closed doors in rooms just off of the chamber, whether it be the House or the Senate. It's certainly, there are speeches made, there are impassioned pleas for certain things, but there is not the back and forth that you would think of when it comes to lawmaking, really, in general. For the most part, there were 217 amendments filed in the House. The vast, vast majority of those will be withdrawn by their members and this is true of almost any major debate in Massachusetts, at least. All of the negotiations are taking place behind closed doors. When they come out to actually, vote on something, most of the decisions have been made by leadership already as to whether or not a certain amendment is going to go forward or not. There was an exception to that, actually, when an amendment from Representative Liz Miranda from Boston that would ban no-knock warrants in cases where there are children or seniors in the residence. So this is something that kind of comes from some incidents that we've seen lately of police, you know, storming in with a warrant legally, however, not taking into account others that might be in the home. This did pass in the House narrowly, which is something that we never see, is a narrow vote on the floor. It was only maybe a dozen or so votes, you know, between success and failure on that one. And it is now going into the bill, and it makes the bill slightly more similar to what the Senate is putting together. So that could be seen as a win for progressives that they fought for on the floor. So not absolutely everything is decided behind closed doors by the leaders, but when it comes to the major outlines of this bill, when it comes to the certification process of police, that is really the core of the bill. That's something that the Speaker and the Governor and the Senate President are all kind of on the same page on. So when a compromise does come and Baker does have a bill in front of him, it will definitely be founded on this new certification and training program that lawmakers are going to put in place.
Aside from the certification issue, which you just said, you know, the big three, as you call them, are on the same page, the governor, the House, and the Senate, it seems. What else is in the House bill? There's been talk that the House version was a little more moderate than what the Senate would like to see.
Yeah, the House is a little more moderate than the Senate is for the most part. And I think that what you're seeing is instead of things that the Senate passed that are, let's say, outright bans on some non-lethal crowd control measures, things like that, the House, instead of banning them outright, is just kind of heavily restricting their use. So instead of really being, you know, locking down what police can and can't do the way the Senate was going to do, the House is leaving a little bit of leeway, a little bit of flexibility in some certain tactics and methods and things like that. One thing that should be noted, though, is that chokeholds are banned in both versions of the bill. That's something that's become very important to most lawmakers in the kind of the Black Lives Matter movement and kind of responding to the immediate incidents that inspired this movement and this legislation. So, you know, you can see the House bill as a more moderate version. It's not nearly as bare bones as the governor's version that he produced a little while ago that was strictly just the certification program without too many other frills. So you can kind of see it as a spectrum with the House in the middle. And that's what we have between the House and the Senate kind of going into this final compromise.
What about police in all of this? There was a protest earlier this week by officers and chiefs, some of whom came up from the Cape to Framingham to oppose some of the measures that both the House and the Senate are considering, with some complaints that the Senate didn't take enough time to get input from police and unions. Has the House done a better job, at least according to police and unions?
According to police, you would say yes. I don't know if it's going to satisfy everyone. The police chiefs are an interesting group because they are, you know, technically management. They are in charge of their departments. However, they're taken very, very, very seriously on Beacon Hill. All, you know, representatives and senators have good relationships, or at least know the chiefs of police in the towns they represent. They are people that they definitely respond to and have a pretty even-keeled idea of how police can and should operate versus, you know, maybe a patrolman's union or someone who's on like the labor side of the divide who might be a little more, you know, radical in their thinking as far as defending the police. So the chiefs have a lot of sway, and they were out in Framingham the other day really railing against certain provisions having to do with civil liability and protections that police have. And now that is an issue that will be settled somehow between the House and Senate when they reconcile the bill. It's probably the main sticking point between the two. And the police will definitely try to continue to influence the negotiators on the final bill. It's also important to mention that Governor Baker may not be totally on board with something that the Democrats put together. Even if it is a compromise between Democrats, the Republican governor may have some different ideas. Police will certainly be lobbying Baker to perhaps exercise his supersized veto authority that he has now this late in the session.
I was going to ask about that because next week is the last week of work for the chambers before they break. And so they really are leaving a lot in the hands of the governor in a certain respect after working so hard on both these bills and then a resolution and a bill that they present next week.
You can't really blame them too much for doing this police reform bill so late in the session. It's something that, you know, again, stemmed out of the Black Lives Matter protests and after the killing of George Floyd. And this is one of the speediest major pieces of legislation that I've seen. It just so happened that it came at the end of the session, and it's really taking a lot of the oxygen out of other issues here as we kind of crash into that July 31st deadline. But there is still an open question as to if lawmakers will continue into August. They still do not have a budget bill in place. They're waiting for kind of federal guidance or federal aid to essentially bail out the state budget. There are numerous other issues that they said that they would get to prior to the pandemic. So activists want them to stay in. Lawmakers don't like to stay in an election year because the closer you get to election day, the more politicized those votes can get. However, only a quarter of lawmakers actually have opponents at all this year. So most of these guys would just be kind of going home to do constituent work in their districts. And with the new virtual formal sessions, they don't have to actually be in Boston. So it is an open question as to whether they'll extend the session for some of those really key important issues that, because of the pandemic, they didn't get to.
Well, that's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks a lot, as always, and have a great weekend.
You too, Catherine.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean. The Cape Cod Commission is moving to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as one of its priorities for the Cape's future development. At a public hearing yesterday, the commission set in motion a six-month process to amend what's called the Regional Policy Plan, with climate change mitigation at the forefront. WCAI's climate and environment reporter Eve Zukoff sat in on this hearing and joins me now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, what exactly happened last night? What did the commissioners decide to do?
Yeah, so commissioners were faced with these 10 amendments proposed by climate activists who said the regional policy plan really needs to focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, combating climate change through, you know, promoting renewable energy, electric cars, not just responding to it with, you know, with coastal adaptations. So last night, in a completely unprecedented move, commissioners said, okay, we're not actually going to vote on these 10 amendments one by one. Instead, what we're going to do is take in the overwhelming public support that mitigates climate change and to form a subcommittee that works with staff of the commission to form our own separate amendments to the regional policy plan.
Now, this is policy and procedure heavy with subcommittees and policy goals, but there was some drama here too. Tell us more about how they got here and what we can expect now as you're looking forward these next 6 months.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this was the third public hearing on this. Each of them have been about 3 hours. And that's because staff for the commission, led by Christy Senatori, have vehemently opposed all of the amendments since the beginning. And a key part of their argument is that the regional policy plan is incredibly important, and it's developed through a public process. It's a delicate balance with other needs like housing growth and transportation efficiency and economic development. And by elevating greenhouse gas reduction, you could sabotage these other efforts. And that's what some commissioners really felt last night. But others felt like, you know, I want to vote for something tonight. One said, I don't want the headline tomorrow to be Cape Cod Commission strikes down climate change advancements. They were really concerned about that. So in these 6 months, commissioners in this subcommittee and staff are actually going to work together. And what they'll probably do is re-engage the public, come back with an emissions reduction goal, like actually really setting what they think it should be, and deliver some new amendments to the regional policy plan on their own. And we'll look forward to that.
And environmentalists basically calling this a victory. That is WCAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests today on the program. We heard from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We heard from Mike Dean at the State House and WCAI's Eve Zukoff there. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio for making all the moves to keep the whole show together. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.